really wants to make a radical overhaul of the legal immigration system here.
But will the U.S. president be able to do that? This is Friday, May 17th, and this is VOA Asia. I'm Ira Melvin in Washington. Make sure you join us on VOA Asia Facebook. Also ahead, the U.S. tries to muscle the world's second biggest smartphone company. It's a Chinese company. U.S.-Iran tension puts some Asian nations in a tough position. And consumers in China and the U.S. are starting to feel the effect of tariffs. It's all on today's VOA Asia. President Donald Trump called Thursday for radical immigration reform to favor skilled English-speaking workers over the poorly educated and to shut the door on what he called frivolous asylum claimants. We welcome to VOA Asia once again VOA White House Bureau Chief Steve Herman. Steve, what else does he want as far as changes are concerned?
Well, Ira, you summed it up pretty well. He really wants to make a radical overhaul of the legal immigration system here in the United States. He did emphasize that his proposal would keep the number of green cards or permanent residencies issued at around the same number, 1.1 million annually. But the shift would be to prioritizing highly skilled and educated individuals with employment or investment prospects rather than the traditional family ties to U.S. citizens or for humanitarian needs. And you might not be surprised to learn that a lot of humanitarian groups are upset with this change. Now, the plan also would completely eliminate what's been called the diversity immigrant visa program, which the president has frequently derided as the green card lottery. That has given 50,000 people from countries, including a lot of people from Asia with low rates of immigration to the United States, some priority. Trump wants to replace this with what he calls the Build America visa to attract these highly skilled people that would use a points-based selection system. And we've seen this in a number of other Western countries being utilized, Canada, Australia, and New Zealand, for example. And also, Ira, I think it's important to mention that what the president wants is to have a test essentially for English language proficiency, as well as a civics exam for anybody that would be legally immigrating to the United States.
What are the chances of this passing in Congress?
Very small, Ira. Democrats are not going to go for this because it doesn't at all address the issue of DACA, the Dreamers, immigrants who were brought to the United States illegally as children. And Republicans, both moderates and conservatives, also have issues with this. And Lindsey Graham, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, he's introducing his own immigration legislation. He says the White House plan is not designed to become law. California Congressman Ted Lieu, who's a Democrat and native of Taiwan, put out a tweet right around the time the president was talking about this, saying that this proposal is dead on arrival. And somewhat facetiously, he said that the House of Representatives will not vote for any immigration plan that would have barred the grandfather of President Trump from immigrating to the United States.
What comes into my mind here is the poem that's inscribed on the Statue of Liberty that says, "Bring me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free." What happened to that?
Well, that is not the type of immigrants that President Trump wants to see in this country. And he believes that that sort of rhetoric during the 2016 campaign helped to get him elected, and that there are a lot of people who share those that philosophy as well. Now, we should also say that there are a lot of Democrats in Congress who do want to see reform for the immigration system and changes to border security. They just have a very different idea of what it should look like. But Look, we're now what, about 18 months from the presidential election. We have 20, what is it, 23 Democrats are running right now. The president's going to have this as a an issue front and center in his reelection campaign. These Democrats will also be forced to address it. And it just seems that there's very little chance of sweeping immigration reform being passed in this current political environment.
Steve Herman is VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Thanks again, Steve.
My pleasure, Ira.
These are among the top Asia stories you'll find right now at voanews.com. Hong Kong student activist Joshua Wong was sent back to jail Thursday over his role in leading the 2014 pro-democracy street protest there. China says two Canadian citizens who have been in detention since late last year have been formally charged with stealing state secrets, a move that's expected to further increase tension between those two countries. Rescue crews pulled 11 people out alive from a collapsed building in China's financial hub of Shanghai on Thursday. Indian troops and separatist militants clashed in Indian-controlled Kashmir Thursday. Officials say 9 people were killed, the latest casualties in a new phase of violence in the 30-year insurgency. You're listening to VOA News. China vowed Thursday to resolutely safeguard Chinese companies after Washington labeled telecom equipment giant Huawei a security risk and imposed export curbs on U.S. technology sales to the company. A foreign ministry spokesman, Liu Kang, criticized the move as an abuse of export control measures after the Trump administration issued an order requiring Huawei to obtain government permission for purchases. Huawei Technologies Limited, the biggest global maker of switching equipment for phone companies, has spent a decade fighting accusations that it facilitates Chinese spying. Huawei is vowing to refuse to assist any country in spying and even claims it would rather go out of business than do that. VOA's Bill Ide recently visited the company's headquarters in China's southern city of Shenzhen.
It is expected 5G will bring explosive growth in connectivity, linking people, homes, cars, industry, and cities. That means more opportunities for business, but also more ways that networks, data, and security can be compromised. Cybersecurity expert Carl Lee.
Right now, all types of human activities are moving online, and after 5G comes, what will be even more worrisome than the commercial applications and sharing of personal information that will come with it is that there will be nothing left that's not online.
Enter Huawei, a global leader in building 5G networks whose connections with the Chinese government have long been a topic of controversy and debate. Washington argues Huawei could be compelled by Beijing to use its equipment for spying. The company strongly denies those accusations, but critics see it as a state-funded extension of the Communist Party. Huawei sees itself as an international enterprise that supports and relies on the global tech supply chain, says the company's chief spokesperson, Joe Kelly.
Today, 4 billion people around the world. The scale at which we operate, if we were installing backdoors and taking data, our carriers would be aware. They would see it for themselves, and then they would stop doing business with us.
Ren Zhengfei, a former military engineer, founded Huawei in 1987 in Shenzhen with a little more than $5,000. Today, the company's massive research and development campus in Dongguan, north of Shenzhen, is a stunning example of the company's rags-to-riches story. Last year, Huawei made more than $100 billion in revenue and says it continued growth in the first quarter, even as Washington tried to block it from global markets. As pressure has mounted with the arrest in Canada of the company's chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, on alleged sanction violations, Huawei has increasingly voiced its willingness to stake the company's continued success on its commitment to security. Company founder Ren Zhengfei says Huawei has never been asked to spy by any country, and if forced to do so, it would stop doing business. Again, Joe Kelly.
He would close the business down rather than compromise the security and safety of any customer's data.
In Xi Jinping's China, however, such promises are hard to believe. Since coming to power, the country's powerful leader has stressed the party's dominance over all aspects of society. Huawei went even further Tuesday when a company executive said it would be willing to sign no-spy agreements with governments. The company official also said cybersecurity is not exclusive to any company. Bill Ide, VOA News, Shenzhen, China.
President Donald Trump also issued an executive order Wednesday that bans telephone carriers from using technology of foreign adversaries deemed to pose unacceptable risks to national security. Happening now in Asia, Pakistani security forces killed 9 Islamic State militants during an hours-long raid near Quetta and the rest of southwest of the country that's been hit by repeated jihadist attacks this month. Officials said 4 members of the security forces were wounded in the operation, which started early Thursday morning. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're happy you're with us on VOA Asia. As the U.S. and China escalate their trade standoff, consumers in both countries are starting to see the impact. VOA's Mikhailo Komodovsky reports from Washington.
Bill Locke has been selling bikes for more than 4 years, and this is the second time his shop has dealt with tariff increases.
The manufacturers tried to eat as much as they could, and then companies like us, you know, tried to eat as much. So the price increase was very small, you know, 5-7% increases.
Locke says customers should buy new bikes as soon as possible, because the prices are going to go up.
A lot of the people, it's going to price them out of the market. They're going to, you know, be used to looking at maybe an entry-level $500 bike that's now going to go to $600. They're going to see a bike that they might have wanted to ride recreationally at $1,000 or $1,500, and that's suddenly going to go to, you know, $1,500 to $2,000, $2,500. They're going to see big price changes coming up over the next, you know, couple months here.
Many buyers themselves say they are not ready to shell out extra cash.
That's not something I want to actually do. I don't want to pay more for a product that costs less before.
I probably wouldn't be willing to pay that much extra if it's due to different tariffs or things like that that are being implemented with the economic tension. Maybe $50-$100 more, but it would probably limit if I wanted to get another bike.
Imposing the new tariff will impact the entire market, Locke explains. The majority of U.S. assembled bikes are not 100% American-made. Either the bike frames, forks, or brakes are manufactured in China. But first, prices for fully Chinese ones will rise up.
So you're looking at a bike that's $500, is going to go up $100.
New prices, Bill says, will possibly scare the customers, leading to greater losses. Then the used bicycle market will come into play.
The problem is a lot of the used bikes in the DC market are stolen. So what it's going to do is it's going to increase the amount of people who are stealing bikes because they can resell them more easily because the price of new bikes has gone up and the price of the used bikes, they can get whatever they can pay for.
Another demonstration of how changes in one part of the economy can lead to unintended consequences elsewhere as the trade war drags on. Mikhailo Komodovsky, VOA News, Washington.
Coming up, what is the connection between major Asian nations and Iran? We'll tell you. You're listening to VOA Asia.
News is mobile, and so are you. Get VOA on the go. Get VOA on Google Currents. Get VOA News specifically made for your tablet and smartphone. Clean, simple, fast. Now available for Android or Apple phones or tablets. Download the Google Currents app for free today. Get VOA on Google Currents at voanews.com/currents.
This news alert from VOA Asia, the International Monetary Fund said Thursday it was holding its forecast for Sri Lanka's 2019 economic growth at 3.5% in spite of devastating Easter bombings, saying it was too early to assess financial damage. The April 21st bombings that killed more than 250 people in churches and hotels were claimed by Islamic State, and they've scared tourists away and soured business sentiment on the island. You're listening to VOA Asia. In the past week, U.S. President Donald Trump hit the brakes, stopping U.S.-China trade negotiations, raising and establishing tariffs on Chinese goods. At the same time, tensions between the United States and Iran have greatly increased. Let's go back a couple of weeks then, when the U.S. ended exemptions for some countries, most of them in Asia, from a ban the U.S. had put on buying Iranian oil. Is there any connection between these hotspots? We welcome to VOA Asia Richard Nephew, adjunct professor and senior research scholar at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University in New York. He has had experience as a U.S. government official dealing with both China and Iran. Richard, welcome to VOA Asia. Is there any area you could think of that could have some connection between the two situations?
Well, I think it's certainly the case that the imposition of tighter oil sanctions against Iran is going to have an impact on Chinese trade interests, right? You know, the Chinese have a very present need for energy and cheap energy. Iran has been a supplier of that. And of course, Iran is also a important country in the Belt and Road Initiative that China is advancing as well. So from a Chinese perspective, Iran is fairly important. And U.S. efforts to try and constrain Chinese ability to do business with Iran is, of course, important as well.
Iran's foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, visited Tokyo Thursday, received a warm welcome from Japan's leader Shinzo Abe, and that followed a trip to India, and a meeting is now scheduled for Friday in Beijing. What do you think Zarif is looking for, and can he get it?
Well, I think Zarif is essentially doing damage control. He's attempting to persuade countries around the world that Iran is the sober and serious actor here, that it's the United States that is causing both instability and threats to international energy supply. And so I think what he's trying to say is, listen, we didn't start this. We didn't start this crisis. We don't want to have a crisis. We're following the rules that are laid out in the nuclear agreement back in 2015. The United States isn't. And so we need you, China. We need you, Japan. We need you, India, to help us. Because, first of all, it's the right thing to do, especially China. You're part of the nuclear agreement. But then also because there is economic interest in doing so. And lastly, because there is an interest in pushing back on the U.S. and the U.S.'s ability to dictate foreign policy decisions to these countries.
Do you think he might be successful in any way, shape, or form, Zarif?
Well, I think he'll be successful in getting international sympathy. He'll be successful in getting international support. He won't necessarily be successful in getting international economic access. So at the end of the day, what I think he will get is a warm reception, handshakes, agreement that the United States is acting recklessly. But at the end of the day, Chinese, Japanese, Indian, and other countries have to make their own decisions, and they have to make them in the full consideration of their economic interests. And in many ways, that comes with not daring the United States to impose sanctions on their oil companies and banks.
And what about Japan? Why such a warm greeting from Abe?
Well, I think the Japanese made a calculation a couple of years ago when Trump was first elected that their national interest at the heart is a strong alliance with the United States, with the region that they live in, with North Korea and with China as potential threats, with the dependence they have on the U.S. military, with the dependence they have on U.S. economic relations. They need the United States. And so I think Abe's approach from the start has been keep Trump close, you know, bear hug him and make sure that he can't withdraw troops from Japan, that he can't downgrade the relationship. And I think that's still kind of their motivating focus. The one thing I will say is this is, of course, a dynamic circumstance and a dynamic situation. You know, as oil prices fluctuate, especially if oil prices go up with the problem the Russians have had exporting oil, with what's going on in Libya, with the threat to Persian Gulf oil coming in and out, I think you're going to have a lot of countries have to make decisions that they aren't really happy with. But if oil starts hitting $100 a barrel or something, you know, that large, they're going to have a real economic reason to consider doing business with Iran, even if the United States doesn't like it. And I think that's going to add a lot of complexity to U.S. decision making.
And what does this do to relationships between Japan, India, China, and the United States? And of course, China, the United States are only already on the way down. So
that's right. I think it creates both direct tensions and issues between the United States and those countries and amongst them. I mean, you can easily see if the Chinese decide to flout U.S. sanctions and Japan has not, that this would be an issue in U.S.-Japanese relations, certainly an issue in Chinese-Japanese relations. You can make similar arguments about India and its economic situation, especially in the context of elections. So I think it has the prospect of raising tensions and causing problems if the U.S. continues to insist on a hard line and isn't consistent with how it approaches all three of those countries.
Richard Nephew is adjunct professor and senior research scholar at the School of International and Public Affairs at Columbia University in New York City. Thank you, Richard.
All right, thank you.
This news alert from VOA Asia. Taiwanese legislators are scheduled to decide Friday on legalizing same-sex marriage, marking a potential first in Asia. Lawmakers pressured over the past 2 weeks by LGBT groups as well as church organizations oppose the same-sex marriage will choose between bills that broadly legalize the unions and give couples many of the tax, insurance, and custody, child custody benefits available to male-female married couples. We continue now. Soil gets tired as repeated farming slowly robs it of nutrients. In the past, farmers would be forced to keep their fields empty for a season while the soil recharged, or plant crops like peanuts and put nutrients back into the soil. But UK researchers are adding garbage to their dirt as a way to keep it healthy. More from VOA's Kevin Enix.
Soil not only helps us grow crops, it holds onto carbon and filters water. But over time, soil gets tired and becomes ineffective at doing those things. The Fab Soil Project at the University of Plymouth in the UK is working on different ways to re-energize tired dirt.
We're trying to create a soil that performs even better than a natural soil because we can actually adapt its functions and the constituents of the soil. So that could have global opportunities for food security, for flood management. And we would like to think that people could take a soil like that and use it themselves and feeling that they're contributing to sustainability.
As part of their research, they're working with the Eden Project, a collection of biodomes meant to preserve exotic plants. It's a closed environment, so workers here have been making their own soil since the project began in 2000.
Across the entire site, our soil depth is about, well, no more than a meter anywhere across site. So it's quite amazing, really, that sort of artificial soil supports the plant life you see today at Eden.
The Eden Project and the Plymouth team are experimenting with adding all kinds of recyclable green waste into tired soil to get it back to work quicker.
The ability to be able to take a product that's a waste from one industry and actually turn it into a bespoke recipe soil for an area that requires restoration, either because it's a mine, same as Eden Project was, or other degradation that has occurred in that area, means that not only are you helping to restore that area, but you're also using a product that otherwise would be just going to landfill.
It's a 3-year project, and the hope is to create a soil that can be used to increase crop yields all over the world. And it can't come fast enough. The UN says about a third of the world's topsoil has been degraded through overuse. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
Scientists at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center and Jet Propulsion Laboratory have found evidence that the moon is geologically more active than thought. The scientists found that a cooling interior is shrinking the moon, which in turn is causing tectonic activity that has been producing moonquakes between 2 and 5 on the Richter scale. Goddard scientists pinpointed moonquake locations by analyzing data gathered by seismometers placed on the lunar surface by Apollo astronauts 47 to 50 years ago. After examining images taken by NASA's Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, JPL scientists found signs of tectonic activity when they noticed curved hills and shallow trenches called wrinkle ridges within one of the vast basins on the moon called mares. The scientists figure the moon shrank by about 50 meters over the last several hundred million years. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
You have been listening to VOA Asia. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, John Ellison, our managing editor, Diane Gal, and the VOA Asia team of Jim Stevenson, Skylar Ogden, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. My name's Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Have a great day.